There's not going to be a liberal state that's going to be good for Judaism. And Herzl, who saw this absolutely clearly, understood that if there's going to be a Jewish state, you know, we can be in favor, we can be in favor of free speech, and we can be in favor of freedom of religion, we can be liberal in all sorts of things, but we can't have a liberal state. So we've been talking about Herzl's return to Judaism, what he called the return to Judaism that brought him to Zionism, to Jewish nationalism, and to the belief that the Jews of Europe should return to the land of Israel, the land of their fathers and mothers, and establish a new national state there, reestablish the Jewish kingdom of old. What I want to do in the coming sessions is to take a look at this Jewish nationalism as an example of the broader phenomenon of nationalism. I want to compare it with liberalism and with conservatism. I want to try to understand what's the relationship between Zionism or Jewish nationalism on the one hand, nationalism on the other, and these broader political categories, broader political theories. Now, Herzl was a conservative in all sorts of ways, not just in the ways that we were speaking about personally in his relationship to Judaism. He was politically close to two conservative governments in Austria. He wrote speeches for Ernst Korber, the Austrian prime minister. And when you read his diaries, you'll see that for a very long time, he had hopes of establishing a conservative daily newspaper. He himself was an editor at the Neue Freie Presse, which was a Jewish-owned liberal newspaper in Austria, the most important one. It was kind of the equivalent of the New York Times. And he was in negotiations with the conservatives in order to establish, I don't know, let's call it the Wall Street Journal or something, that he was going to be the editor of. So Herzl's political theory is conservative in various ways, but that doesn't, of course, necessarily go hand in hand with being a Zionist or a nationalist. I mean, there have been plenty of nationalists who were liberal, socialist, even communist. Moses Hess is a good example. I mentioned Hess's Roman Jerusalem as an outstanding statement of Jewish nationalism a couple of decades before Herzl. And Hess was a communist, and he's still some kind of socialist. And if you want to see how he works it out, then you really should take a look. But the fact that people can make all sorts of interesting combinations doesn't answer sort of the theoretical question of what things work with what things imply what things, if you want to be consistent. Now, human beings don't have to be consistent. And sometimes you can do great things through inconsistency. But at the same time, there are patterns that are clear and worth noticing. So we'll take Herzl's return to Judaism, Herzl's Zionism, his proposal, his advocacy of the idea that Jews should regather themselves in a Jewish state. Now, from the moment that Herzl started moving in this direction, really, I mean, long before he was even a public figure, he ran into, began colliding with, the hostility of liberal Judaism. Okay, and I'm not saying that there weren't ultimately Orthodox Jews who were also, for their own reasons, hostile to Zionism. But if we take a look at what Herzl's political world was like, the principal fight was with liberal Judaism, with liberals who came to say to him, What are you doing? What are you doing? Don't you see that the salvation for the Jews comes from liberalism? Right? We've had thousands of years of persecution in the exile, and being hated and being despised and being shut out of businesses, and who freed us from the ghetto? Who gave us opportunities? Here in Austria, in Germany, in France, who was it? The liberals, of course. It was the liberal party that allowed Jews to step forward into the world on a basis of individual equality. So Herzl knew very early on that what he was doing was angering and upsetting and actually embarrassing the liberal Jews who were, you know, for example, his employers at his newspaper. They detested what he was doing. I want to try to understand what is it that they so detested? I mean, this is something that we see to this very day, that the principal opposition to nationalism and to Zionism comes from liberalism. Why? What is this? Now, we at the beginning, in the first lecture, we talked about this already a little bit. If you remember, I was talking about the Lockean view, Locke's view, that sees the state as fundamentally being a contract, an agreement among individuals who come together to defend their lives, their property, and their freedoms. It's a very, very individualistic, particularistic kind of picture. There are no nations in this picture, or if there are nations, if the word nation is used, it's used to describe whatever group it is that comes together in order to voluntarily create this social contract in order to defend their lives and their property. Okay, but that's not what historically or traditionally, certainly not in the Bible, that's not what a nation historically was. Historically, what a nation was a group of people who have linguistic or religious or historical heritage, a heritage that binds them, and a mutual loyalty and a willingness to defend themselves, to defend one another and work together, whether or not they have a state. Now, there's the nation traditionally was something that existed prior to the state, just like the family exists prior to the state. The family isn't created by the state. It's prior to the state. The same thing is true with the clan, the tribe, and the nation. Now, liberalism is not necessarily associated with imperialism. It doesn't automatically follow. Just because you've adopted this view that human beings are fundamentally, all of them, equal in the things that they want, and you know from universal reason that what they want is these particular things, life, liberty, and property, and not other things. Just because you've accepted that view and embraced it and take it seriously doesn't immediately mean that you're going to, you know, run for office on a platform of let's conquer the world. On the other hand, there is an important a connection, which is reasonably direct, between liberal views like Locke's or Rousseau's. Rousseau's is a little bit more complicated, but in the things that we've discussed so far, he is a follower of Locke. There is a connection between this kind of a view and imperialism. The connection is that the claim that's being made, the claim that Hobbes makes it, Locke makes it, it's even more clearly implicit in Rousseau and in Kant. The claim is that there's only one way, one legitimate way of thinking about the political world, and it's this way. Right? That's what universal reason means. Locke or Rousseau say, I am now going to describe what reason dictates with respect to the political order. I'm now going to tell you what you must think. And Rousseau goes so far as to say that any constitution that is not constructed according to the social contract model that I have proposed, this is in his book, The Social Contract, 1762, he goes so far as to say that any government on earth that varies even in the slightest from the social contract as I'm going to describe it is an illegitimate government. And people who are not willing to accept the social contract state as I describe it, the state has no choice but to either execute them or exile them. Okay, this claim of an absolute universalism, of having found the absolute truth, the final truth about political regimes, it's then taken up by Kant and it becomes the basis for much of later liberal theorizing. Okay, so not every liberal thinker says, well, if people don't agree with me, you have to exile them or kill them, the way that Rousseau does. But when you say there is no legitimate alternative to my view, then you've created a view that is extremely intolerant. It's both extremely intolerant and it claims to universal to universality. It claims that everywhere on earth this is true. Now, if you take this seriously, and you know, luckily for many liberals have not taken this literally seriously. They've historically often mixed their liberalism with other things, with religion, with nationalism, with traditionalism, with skepticism, all of which are things that are not part of this rationalistic framework. And so you get somebody like let's say John Stuart Mill or Isaiah Berlin, who are not dogmatists, right? They reach a lot of liberal conclusions, so you can call them liberals, but they're not of this kind. They don't claim that they have the absolute universal truths the way that Locke and Rousseau and Kant do. So they're more moderate. You can have people like that. Thank God there are people like that. But for those people who are convinced that Rousseau is right, and this social contract, this version of individual rights and equality is the only legitimate constitution, that's an imperialist mindset. That's a mindset that doesn't really see any barriers to saying, well, everybody should think like this. And that's a question of how far do they want to take everybody really just should think like this. Are they willing to put armies behind it? Well, in the French Revolution, they did. Napoleon took these ideas and said, that's it. We have the final ideas. We have Rousseau's social contract. They gave out copies. Instead of giving out the Bible to the soldiers, they gave out Rousseau's social contract to the soldiers, and then they sent them out to take over Europe. Millions of people died. And the argument was, I, Napoleon, I know the truth. The truth is this liberal doctrine that I got from Rousseau. And the fact that the Republic of Venice has stood in Venice for 1,000 years is of no consequence to me because I have the ultimate truth. Venice is finished. It's gone. The same thing with any other country that was conquered by Napoleon. Among the Jews, this relationship between Napoleon and liberalism and universal truth is of decisive importance. The Jews had always considered themselves to be a people, to be a nation. Historically, that's what our prayers say. That's what our Torah says. That's the way Jews talked historically, and the Europeans thought so too. I mean, the other nations of Europe looked at the Jews as a nation, a scattered nation, but a nation. And when Napoleon takes the social contract of Rousseau and is going to apply it, he gathers together the Jews. This is, the year is 1807. And he says, well, the Jews can't continue being a nation. If they're a nation, that means they're not loyal to France. If they're not loyal to my French nation or to my empire, if they're not loyal, if they're loyal to some other thing because they're some other nation, they're pledging allegiance to some other historical goal, if that's what they're going to do, well, then they're going to be exiled, just like Rousseau says. So he gathers together 71 rabbis from France and Italy, and he says, look, Judaism's not going to continue this way. You're going to become French and Italian. You're going to become whatever is demanded of you, just like everybody else. You're going to become equal. Napoleon's the great equalizer. He's going to equalize everybody. And he demands that the rabbis equalize themselves. And if they don't equalize themselves, then out of here. And they do. And there's this, you know, extraordinary document. The Hebrew is actually less humiliating than the French version, but it's bad enough. The French version is just really perfectly clear. The French version says, you know, we renounce our status. We're no longer a people. We no longer have political loyalties to anything or anyone else other than you, Napoleon, and from now on, Judaism is going to be an individual, private thing. It's no longer a national thing. The famous declaration of one of the liberal parliamentarians in the French Parliament: to the Jews as individuals, everything; to the Jews as a nation, nothing. Many Jews either thought they had no choice, or they thought this was just a fantastic idea. I'd like to have everything as an individual. That's nice that they got everything. Jewry has been divided since 1807 on this question. German Jewry flooded in the direction of embracing Napoleon conquered Middle Europe. He liberated the Jews. All they had to do was renounce their nationhood, their loyalty to the Jewish people as a historic entity, to Jewish people around the world. All they had to do was renounce that, and then they'd be citizens, equal citizens. That wasn't historically quite that simple. It took a while. Some people would argue that it never was completely completed, but whatever. Roughly, the story of the last 200 years of Judaism in Western nations is some kind of attempt to resolve the fact that we are a people, and we are a nation, and the truth is that most Jews have never given that up, regardless of what was written in that document. And the fact that some Westerners are sufficiently extreme in taking the social contract business seriously to actually think that there's something wrong with the Jews continuing to be a nation. If you're a liberal, in the sense that I'm using the word, I understand other people use it in other senses, I think this is a perfectly good sense, and I'm going to use it this way, and I suggest you do too, but if you want to use it some other way, fine, just bear with me, okay? If you're a liberal in the sense that I've defined it, right, you believe that the fundamental constitutional reality of a good society is one that is described by equal individuals. Everybody living on a given territory are equal individuals coming together voluntarily in a social contract to get equal rights, right? That's if you're willing to think that way, if that's the way you see things, you think that that's sufficient as a description of political reality. Well, so you're going to have serious problems with someone who comes along and says, well, I want to organize, what I want to do is I want to establish a Jewish state. People say, what on earth is a Jewish state? Amos Oz, one of the great Israeli liberal writers and thinkers, famously says, there's no such thing as a Jewish state, any more than there's such a thing as a Jewish chair or a Jewish bus. You can't have a Jewish state. They're only Jewish people. There's no such thing as a Jewish state. Herzl didn't know that. He wrote a book called The Jewish State. The reason that he wrote a book called The Jewish State is because he's not a liberal. Right? And his book, in fact, is an attack on Rousseau. It's an explicit attack, not an implicit. It explicitly takes on Rousseau, and it explicitly takes on the social contract, and it says, look, the truth is this social contract is false. It's never actually been the basis for any state, and it's not going to be the basis for the Jewish state either. The basis for the state is actually something else. It's a different metaphor that he uses. He calls it negatorium gestio, which is ironically maybe a term derived from Roman law. But it just means that the state is based on the principle of guardianship. People who take responsibility for a people, they take initiative and take responsibility for a people and establish a government, however they do it, right? If they take responsibility for caring for other people, they organize an army, they organize a bureaucracy, they organize a taxation system, and then they work to advance the interests of a given people and to protect them and take care of them. That's the basis of the state, says Herzl. He says it's always the basis of the state. By the way, if you want to see a clear historical example of that demonstrates that Herzl was right and Locke and Rousseau were wrong, read John Ellis's book, The Quartet, the best-selling book about the American founding, in which Ellis, I think, completely convincingly argues that four individuals, with the help of some others, but basically four individuals, Washington, Hamilton, Madison, and John Jay, four individuals decided on their own that there had to be a unified constitution for all of the American colonies, and they had to become one nation. And it traces how they, almost alone among political leaders in believing this, how they succeeded in getting it done. It's a clear case of what Herzl is calling guardianship. They saw the problem, they thought the people needed the help, and they went ahead and they made it happen, and you go try to find any kind of social contract involved in what it is that they did. The idea that there's going to be a state whose purpose is to guard the Jews already steps out of the liberal framework. Luckily, there are many other important political thinkers who weren't liberals. So I mentioned the conservative tradition in England, John Fortescue, Coke, Selden. I mentioned those. You could add Edmund Burke. Let's take Montesquieu, because Montesquieu is often considered to be a liberal thinker, and in certain respects, in some moods he is, but in some ways he's very, very much a conservative, and especially on this particular point. Right? When Montesquieu is surveying the nations of the world, he says that actually, states can have completely different purposes. I mean, there are some basic purposes, right? You know, every state does have to, like, protect people. Otherwise, it's not a state if it's not actually, like, protecting the people on the territory. But in general, he says, each state has a purpose that's peculiar to itself. Expansion was the purpose of Rome. War was the purpose of Sparta. Religion was the purpose of the Jewish law. Of the Jewish state. He says the purpose was God. Commerce, the purpose of Marseille. Public tranquility, that of the laws of China. Navigation is the goal of the laws of Rhodes. The independence of each individual is the purpose of the laws of Poland, and what results from this is the oppression of everyone. And there's also one nation whose constitution has political liberty as its direct purpose, writes Montesquieu, and that, of course, is England. Montesquieu represents this other tradition. You can add to the names I mentioned David Hume, you can add Adam Ferguson. There's plenty of conservative thinkers in this tradition, but they're just not the ones that are mostly studied when we study politics, because we study liberals. If you're part of this tradition, then you think that this idea of a universal one constitution that is alone legitimate for everyone is simply false. It can't be. Different peoples have different values, different aspirations, different needs. right? And you want to know how a Jewish state is supposed to be operated, how it's going to be constructed. You need to know what the needs of the Jews are. So one need of the Jews, obviously, at the time when Herzl was thinking about this, is how do you help a nation that's scattered around the globe, even the basic thing of protecting them, right? They're being persecuted everywhere around the globe. How do you help them? Now, the social contract is completely worthless for this, because the social contract in Hobbes and Locke and Rousseau and Kant and so on is always within some given territory. There's some given territory, and everybody in it supposedly voluntarily agreed. And if they didn't agree really, then you say that they tacitly agreed. You just assert that they agreed. And that's the basis for government. But here Herzl's organizing a government for people that scattered around the world. What social contract is there going to be? There's none. He says, I'm doing this because they need help, and no one's helping them, and that's why I'm the government. It's kind of neat, actually, I think. Burke, in 1781, in the Parliament in England, writes about the Jews, having no fixed settlement in any part of the world, no kingdom nor country in which they have a government, a community and a system of laws, they're thrown on the benevolence of the nations. This is Burke in Parliament talking about the Jews. He says, look, there's no one to help them. If Dutchmen are injured and attacked, the Dutch have a nation, a government, and armies to redress and revenge their cause. If Britons be injured, Britons have armies and laws, the law of nations, to fly to for protection and justice. But the Jews have no such power, and they have no such friend to depend on. Humanity, then, must be their protector and their ally. Now, what an extraordinary and gracious sentiment. You'll notice that Burke is not, by any stretch of the imagination, he's a liberal. The reason he's saying this is because he's a Christian and an Englishman, and he feels that it's right for Christians and Englishmen to protect the Jews. There's a whole tradition of this. And in fact, by 1840, the government of England, Lord Palmerston was the prime minister, in 1840, the government of England actually extends British military protection and diplomatic protection to all the Jews living in the Holy Land. They instruct the consul in Jerusalem to do a census of all the Jews, and England's going to make sure that they're taken care of. And this is a completely Christian impulse. Palmerston was put up to this by a strong Christian lobby in England, a Protestant lobby that wanted to see the Jews protected because they want to see the Jews be able to go home, because that's what it says in the Bible. Liberalism doesn't do this. Only Christianity does this kind of thing when it feels like it. So the English did help us. The English organized with the help of the Zionists. They negotiated with Herzl a homeland for the Jews. Herzl dies before World War I, but in World War I, the English agreed to establish a Jewish unit in the British Army with Jewish insignia and the beginnings of a Jewish army. They conquer the land of Israel. They declare the Balfour Declaration, and they announce it's time for the Jews to come home. Whoa, you know, there really are not a lot of peoples that have done as much for the Jews in history as the English have done. And you can say almost equally powerful things in favor of the Americans. The Americans inherit this English Christian Protestant interest in the Bible and in the Jews, and at all sorts of key stages, the Americans have been terrific to the Jews. I fervently mean what I just said. The Jews have never had friends as good as the English and the Americans. But at the same time, the idea that England or America can be the guardian of the Jews in some kind of permanent sense is absurd. It's absurd. I mean, I'm sorry to say it, but historically it turns out to be false. By the time that we get to World War II, when the chips are down, really down, and England is on the verge of being wiped out from history, and America is fighting for its life, and the Jews need help, there is no one in England or in America to talk to. Okay, that all that goodwill, that was great, you know, when times were good, when we had a lot of power, when the Christian lobby was really, really strong and their votes mattered. All that's gone in World War II. World War II, at the latest, by 1942, the English and the Americans know exactly what's going on. Hundreds of thousands of Jews have already been killed. It's in the New York Times. It's not in intelligence reports. It's in the New York Times. The truth, it's buried, you know, it's in some little item in the New York Times. But it's in the New York Times. Everybody knows that the Germans are killing the Jews of Europe. And for the next 3 years, they continue to kill the Jews of Europe as the intelligence reports just get clearer and clearer and clearer. And they know exactly what's going on. They know exactly where it's going on. And their bombers are flying right past the railroad tracks. And there's no one in England, not Churchill, the great friend of the Jews, not Roosevelt, the great friend of the Jews, no one, nothing. And not only that, but the English, who had been given, you know, under, you'll forgive the scare quotes and the sarcasm, but I think it's merited in this case. Under international law, the English had been given the mandate to establish a Jewish national home in Palestine and to bring the Jews home. Well, that mandate works okay up until the eve of the war, and then they just get scared that the Arabs are going to like join the Nazis, which in any case many of them did. But they get so frightened of that they shut the gates to Palestine. And while Jews are being slaughtered in Europe, the gates are closed, and Jews who can escape Europe have to try to get past the English blockade to get into Palestine. Because the English, it's not just the English won't let them into England, and the Americans won't let them into America. They won't let them into Palestine, where they have an international legal obligation to let them into Palestine. They won't let them into Palestine. Herzl saw this. He wrote in 1895 in his diary that a horrible conflagration is coming. He actually explicitly put his hopes in the English. He said the only place in Europe that isn't absolutely laced with hatred of the Jews is England. And his assessment turned out to be right. He wrote, "What form this destruction of the Jews is going to take, I can't guess. Will it be revolutionary expropriation from below or a reactionary confiscation from above? Will they drive us out? Will they kill us? In France, there will come a social revolution whose first victims are going to be the big bankers and the Jews. In Russia, there'll simply be a confiscation of whatever they want to confiscate. In Germany, they'll make emergency laws. It'll all be legal," which is exactly what they did, of course. "In Austria, people will let themselves be intimidated by the Viennese rabble." What he didn't foresee is that the Viennese rabble took over Germany and wrote those laws. "There, you see, in Vienna, the mob can achieve anything." That's in 1895. In 1942, at an assembly at a meeting of the Jewish National Assembly in Palestine, where the extermination of the Jews in Europe is officially announced, Ben-Gurion says as follows: "We do not know exactly what goes on in the Nazi Valley of Death, or how many Jews have been slaughtered. We do not know whether the victory of democracy and freedom and justice will not find Europe a vast Jewish cemetery in which the bones of our people are scattered. We're the only people in the world whose blood as a nation is allowed to be shed. Only our children, our women, our aged are set apart for special treatment, to be buried alive in graves dug by them, to be cremated in crematoriums, to be strangled and to be murdered with machine guns, and all this but for one sin, because the Jews have no political standing, no Jewish army, no Jewish independence, and no homeland. What has happened to us in Poland, what may, God forbid, happen to us in the future, all our innocent victims, all the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, and perhaps millions, are the sacrifices of a people without a homeland. We demand a homeland and independence." Again, I'm not interested in blaming the Americans or the British, the best friends we've ever had. I'm not interested in blaming anybody. I'm interested in what, as a Jew, I'm supposed to do. And as a Jew, I think that I would be a fool to believe any kind of claim that says that when the chips are down, the Americans will look out for the Jews, or the British will look out for the Jews. It's not the job of the Americans and the British to look out for the Jews. When they are able to help us, thank God they will, and I'm grateful for it. And when we're able to help them, the same. I'm proud of the historic relationship we have with the Americans and the British, and I hope in the future it'll be very strong, and they'll contribute to us and we'll contribute to them. But in the end, at the bottom line, the only people who are going to divert their resources, divert their lives to the goal of saving Jews are Jews. There'll be individual Christians and other well-meaning people everywhere who'll help us in small numbers. They'll risk their lives because there are good people everywhere. But as a nation, the only organized nation that you can count on is going to be the Jews. And it hasn't been that long. We've seen it with our own eyes, and we don't need to be taught this again. That's the reality. Now, when a Jew thinks about the United States or Britain or any other country, then he or she, I believe, needs to think in these terms, that if your concern is for Jews and Judaism and the future of Judaism, then it's to Israel that you look first and foremost and always. Here, let me show you what the liberal alternative looks like. There are many Jewish liberals in Germany writing pans of praise to Germany in the 100 years before the Holocaust. I'm just going to read you one, the great German Jewish philosopher Hermann Cohen, who is also one of the greatest Kantian philosophers who ever lived. In other words, he devoted his entire life to building up Kant, to building up Kant and Germany. But he was also a warm Jew, a loyal Jew, in the sense of wanting good for his people, feeling that he should do good for his people. He didn't turn his back on his people. But his ideas, I'm sorry, his liberal Jewish ideas were so completely, so intolerably, so absurdly screwed up. Okay, I mean, this is the greatest Jewish mind of the century. And they were so completely screwed up that he wrote a little book called Germanism and Judaism in 1915 in order to show that Germanhood, the German love of freedom, the German values, the German universal thinking and reason, that they are the center of the world and that all Jews have to identify with Germany. We're talking about 1915. We're talking about 18 years before Hitler comes to power. And he writes, the inner commonality, the inner commonality between Germans and Judaism should now be evident to everyone. The concept of humanity has its origins in the messianism of the Israelite prophets. Now, however, the Messiah is again to be found within the framework of the German spirit. The Jews in France, England, and Russia are all subject to the duty of loyalty to Germany because Germany is the motherland of their souls. Accordingly, irrespective of common prejudices, I venture to assert that the equality of the Jews in Germany is more deeply rooted than anywhere else. Remember what the rabbi said, to he who lives outside the land of Israel, it's as if he worships idols. This man has a good heart. He's just so completely confused that 18 years before the onset of Nazi Germany and the Holocaust, he's telling us that it's in Germany, that Germany is the essence of the Jewish spirit has found its fruition. Okay, I don't believe this kind of stuff. Judaism is not Germanism, it's not Americanism, it's not Britishism, it's not Frenchism, it's something else. It's something else. And if that something is what we owe our first loyalty to, then the place that we take our stand, that we make our stand, is with Herzl, is with the establishing a Jewish state. If that's not where your soul is, if you're an American, and, you know, Judaism is for you some kind of historical, you know, curiosity or a hobby or something that you do, you know, with some of your spare time, you know, like lots of other things. So you're an American. Okay, I get it. Fine. But if you're a Jew, then a Jew means a Jewish nationalist. A Jew means somebody who's going to work every day with his or her entire life, not part of your life, in order to strengthen that instrument which is going to protect the Jews when the time comes. Now, I've just talked all about physical survival. Physical survival. It's a little bit, it's just in the shadow of the Holocaust, it's hard not to talk about it. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that I think our entire argument, we Zionists, we Jewish nationalists, has to be based, I know some disagree with me about this, it has to be based on there being something beyond survival. I mean, if there's no point other than survival, then in a sense the liberals are basically just right. I mean, so do everything you can to assimilate and hope you can pull it off, you know, save your life and the lives of your descendants and save us all the trouble. But if there's a reason to be a Jew, if there's a God in heaven, if the Torah means anything, if the history of God's loyalty to us and the loyalty of our ancestors to our traditions means anything, if Scripture has anything to teach the world, if there's any kind of blessing to be gained for ourselves as individuals or as a nation or for the world from the fact that Judaism will not just survive, but it will flourish and grow strong and be a roaring blaze, as Herzl describes it, and throw light on all the world, if there's something in that, well, if there's something in that, then we have a reason also to survive. So then the physical stuff has meaning. Then it has purpose other than, you know, mere animal survival. The flourishing of the Jewish spirit is not something that can happen outside of Israel either. Now, obviously, there have been exceptions, just like there are exceptions that, you know, sometimes the Americans and the British and others are really good to the Jews, and they're exceptions. They protect us. The same thing is true of Jewish spirit. That you look through the history of the exile, you know, who can deny the, you know, the greatness of the achievements of the Babylonian Talmud or of the Rishonim, the medieval Jewish commentators and philosophers and Talmudists in Spain and in other places? You can't deny it. These are extraordinary achievements, but these are little bubbles in a history of oppression. Ahad Ha'am, who you may remember, I mentioned as a rather nasty man. The thing about Ahad Ha'am is that he's really nasty when he's writing about Herzl or Zionism. If he's writing about something else, then he often actually says wise things. Now, Ahad Ha'am's not really, you know, not a political conservative like Herzl is. I mean, he's kind of like, I mean, he's a little bit, you know, a little bit of a drama queen kind of, you know, he's like, the Jewish people will not be redeemed by diplomats. They will be redeemed by prophets. You know, that kind of stuff. But he's no friend to liberalism, Ahad Ha'am. This is Ahad Ha'am's assessment of Jewish culture, Jewish thought, Jewish learning and spiritual growth and thinking under liberalism. He writes, it's only in the latest period, the period of emancipation and assimilation. In other words, the liberal period, you know, since 1807, since we were freed from the ghettos, he writes, that Jewish culture has really become sterile and has ceased to bear new fruit. Why? Why is that? This doesn't mean that our creative power has been suddenly destroyed or that we're no longer capable of doing original work. It is the tendency to sink the national individuality and to merge it into that of other nations. He's saying the same exact thing we heard Herzl say. To merge our unique personality into the nations that has produced this characteristic phenomenon of our time. The really original intellects desert their own poverty-stricken people and give their efforts to the enrichment of those who are already rich, while our literature remains a barren field for dullards and mediocrities to trample on. Even what is good in our literature is only good because it resembles more or less the good products of other national literatures. We cannot feel that our national life is linked with a literature like this, which is in its essence nothing but purveyor of foreign goods, presenting the ideas and feelings of foreign writers in a vastly inferior form. This is the same, you remember that Ezekiel, Yechezkel, his vision was the Jews will gather into the land of Israel. First, the bones will come together and will be flesh. First, the physical ingathering, and then a spiritual. Then the wind comes, then the breath brings us to life. And here he's talking about the breath of life. And again, to be a new Jewish nationalist is to make a choice. Are you going to devote your heart and your talents and your soul to the building up of German culture, the way that Hermann Cohen did? He devoted his whole life to German culture. Judaism was an afterthought almost. Not an afterthought, but a small sideshow. He built up Germany. We can do that too. We can build up America. We can build up Australia. We can build up, you know, Malaysia. We can build up anything. But Herzl says, no, we're going to build up Judaism. Now, I say that you can't, Ahadam is right, you can't do this under liberalism. Why? Well, think about this. You're going to go to a public school. You're going to go to a school, not a Jewish school, a school of all its citizens, for all the citizens in the country. They're all going to go to a certain school, and they're going to get to an American education or an English education. Are they going to get a Jewish education? No, they are not going to get a Jewish education. In the old days, the public schools in the United States were Protestant, Christian, U.S. nationalist schools. So if a Jew went to them, then you'd get, you know, a Protestant American nationalist education. Today, the schools mostly are not that. Today, the schools are liberal instead. And so you get a liberal education. My children, thank God, I have 9 children. The youngest, I have 2 twin 9-year-olds. And you should see what it is for a 9-year-old child who knows the Torah, who knows Tanakh, who knows Midrash. It's really quite scary. It's intimidating. They know Mishnah. They're learning the basic rabbinic texts. And you can throw questions from any direction, and they know something. They learn it in the original language. They learn in Hebrew. They don't live off of these terrible translations, these tendentious, terrible translations. Now, they're supported by the government. The Israeli government is supporting them. If you want an education like this in America, well, you basically can't get it because you can't replace the extraordinary gift of being able to speak Hebrew as your native tongue and your basic way of thinking from childhood. But even, let's say, there are good Jewish schools in America. So what? What are they charging now? $30,000 a year? $40,000 a year? And please don't talk to me about vouchers. We're talking, I'm in favor of it, it's fine. It's not a solution to the problem. The problem is that this is not a Jewish country. America is not a Jewish country. Its purpose is not the spiritual resuscitation and flourishing and growth and the attainment of the dreams of the Jews. And that's not a criticism of America. It's just what America has to take care of the dreams of Americans. It doesn't have to take care of the dreams of the Jews. Now, America has its own traditions. I myself personally am not a big fan of this Jeffersonian separation of church and state thing. I think that for Christians to be sending their kids to schools in which they never study a page of scripture and they never hear the word God, I think it's national suicide for the Americans. I think it's completely crazy. But it's an American craziness. It's not a Jewish craziness. We have our own craziness. Our own mistakes that we're going to make ourselves. But this mistake we don't make. We send our children to schools where they all study Bible. and there's nothing wrong with it. And it doesn't violate any highfalutin philosophical Jeffersonian principle. It's just what Jews should do in a Jewish state and a Jewish government. And we could go on, and there are many, many other examples. Each nation has its own purposes and its own goals and its own values. And liberalism, which presumes, you know, like Marxism before it, presumes to be able to, and I don't mean that the liberals are as bad as the Marxists. Nothing is as bad as the Marxists. I don't mean anything like that. But still, too much like the Marxists, liberals, when they get a little bit fanatical and they forget that they need to mix their liberalism with other things to make them sane, and they start getting dogmatic about this, they create something that is so completely hostile to Judaism. You read Dawkins or Sam Harris. I actually have a lot of respect for both of them. They're very intelligent men. Harris especially, I think he's very brave on various things. But you know, they really think that educating a child in Judaism from childhood is like child abuse, because you're taking away from them the right to independently reason. There's not going to be a liberal state that's going to be good for Judaism. And Herzl, who saw this absolutely clearly, understood that if there's going to be a Jewish state, you know, we can be in favor of free speech, and we can be in favor of freedom of religion, we can be liberal in all sorts of things, but we can't have a liberal state because there are other purposes that are important to us. And they're the reason that we, as guardians of the Jews, guardians of the Jewish people who take it upon ourselves to protect this people and help it flourish, there are other reasons that we're going to establish a Jewish state, which is going to be different from all the other nations in the world. And only then can we do good for ourselves and for everyone else.